Mr. Benham, reel 2. Mr. Benham, was there any particular financial advantage in joining the Royal Naval Division?
You ought not ask me that question. There was, because the Royal Navy doesn't have any rank equivalent to a second lieutenant in the army. There is no such rank in the Navy. And it is the lowest form of army commission rank, but it isn't anything. There isn't anything equivalent in the Navy. And so in the Naval Division, we were all sub-lieutenants, which is the lowest naval commission rank, and a sub-lieutenant ranks with a lieutenant in the army. So in order to let the army know what rank we used to wear two stars on our shoulders, and the naval, what do you call it, the naval officer's ring and executive curl in khaki on our cuffs. And we enjoyed the advantage of getting 8 and 6 pence a day as against a second lieutenant 7 and 6 pence a day.
Did the men, the other men,
in order not to confuse the army as to ranks, the corporals who were called leading seamen used to wear two stripes on one arm and the single anchor on the other. And the sergeants, were known as petty officers, wore three stripes on one arm and crossed anchors on the other arm. There wasn't an equivalent rank for a sergeant major, but they were called warrant officers. And they used to wear the army badge for that. The regimental sergeant majors, when they mainly came from the Marines, which is in any case uses army rank as a rule, but they didn't all, and some of them were naval, but they all wore the army badge for that, the Royal Coat of Arms, which is the regimental sergeant major's badge. And shut that thing off. I'll tell you something. After I was commissioned, I was serving at Blandford in Dorset, and I went to France in November 1917. When I got out there, the snow was all over the Western Front, and there'd been very severe frost, and there were a lot of frozen-in corpses which couldn't be moved and buried owing to the keenness of the frost. And there's another interesting thing, too, that just before I went out there, the Germans had made an early dawn attack across the snow with whitened rifles and wearing white sheets. And they were practically invisible in the murk on the snow. And they'd driven back the other battalion who were in there at the time with very great casualties because they weren't even seen. And we had several of these bodies lying there frozen in their white sheets, unable to be moved because of the frost. Is that...
Were you in charge of the party that dug them out?
Oh, I was going to tell... When the frost broke, it was, I think, January by that time. It was bitterly cold through Christmas. And when the frost broke, at last, we were able to get the bodies down. One of them was Lieutenant Alan, Sub-Lieutenant Alan Campbell, the son of Mrs. Patrick Campbell, the actress. Yeah. We managed to get these bodies down to the burial ground about 5 or 6 miles behind the front line, and I had the unenviable job of being in charge of the burial party. We carried the men over the trenches until we got to where the transport could come, and then they were put in GS wagons. The bodies were put in GS wagons, wrapped in blankets, and taken down for burial. The chaplains waiting for us of the various denominations at the cemetery. And after that, it was the rest of my party went on to draw rations, went down to the ration dump a few miles further on to draw rations for the battalion, but that wasn't any part of my job. And I turned back to walk the 5 miles back up to the line. It was a pouring wet afternoon, squally sleet going down our necks, and the roads all full of puddles and cell holes. And presently I had my orderly with me, and presently we heard the swish of a car coming along. And my orderly, who was a dour Scot, said, "Some ruddy staff waller, sir." I said, "Yes, I expect so." And instead of swishing past us with a shower of mud and water on us, it stopped. And a cheerful young voice said, "Would you chaps like a lift?" And I found that I was being offered a lift by the Prince of Wales, who was on one of his tours of the front line. He and I, my orderly sat up beside his driver, and he and I with his equerry sat in the back. And he had a long talk. He asked me a lot of questions about the Royal Naval Division and about my home, and I found him more than interesting. Eventually, after about 3 or 4 miles, his way was different from mine, and he put us down and we trudged on back to the trenches. Mm-hmm. Now, just switch that thing off a minute now.
Did you ever see the Prince of Wales again?
Yes, under very different circumstances. I think it was about 1922. I was a scoutmaster then of a small troop in Sussex, East Sussex. And there was a rally at Alexandra Palace. A pot of welcome, it was called by the chief scout, to welcome the Prince of Wales back from one of his world tours. And I, with the help of financial help from the district commissioner, managed to take, I think it was 10 boys, up to this rally. And I'd trained them to stand very still, because they had to stand for at least an hour before the prince came, and very glad I was that I'd done this, because they were about the only troop near me that really stood still. And the Prince of Wales finally came. He went down one long line of the scouts and then back along the other line of the scouts. And he wasn't really expected to come and inspect the scoutmasters at all. But he did. And when he got to me, he looked at me and he said, "I know you." In that quick, incisive way that he had, "I've met you before. Don't tell me. I shall get it." I said, "Yes, sir, I have met you." "I know. Western Front. Gave you a lift in my car, didn't I? A pouring wet afternoon." That, I think, is an example of the royal memory.
Yes. To return to the Royal Naval Division, there was quite a lot of competition. You had to be very good to get into the Royal Naval Division.
I don't think you had to be good. I think you had to be lucky. A lot of people got in. I don't think you had to be good. When you were in, the only thing was that there was a lot of cadets wanted to get commissions in the Naval Division, because it was quite a unique sort of crowd, and therefore they tended to be the ones that passed out the highest in the final examination that they gave you at the end of the course. And I happened to get German measles a couple of weeks before the first examination I should have had, and couldn't sit for it, and was put back with the next lot going through, and so had an extra 5 or 6 weeks tuition, and I think this enabled me to pass out fairly high, and so able to get my wish of getting into the Naval Division. But it wasn't any different. We were fought as infantry, and we were treated as infantry. And when I was wounded on the Western Front in April 1918, and was evacuated to England, and we came across hospital ship. Landing officers came aboard just before we reached Dover, and they said that officers of the Brigade Guards and certain specialist officers could go to London, but the rest, it was either Plymouth or Manchester. I pointed out that I, with another Naval Division officer, that we were specialist officers, as we belonged to the Royal Naval Division. And the remark was tersely made, "You fight as infantry, you go as infantry." And we did fight as infantry. And so I was put on a train. I chose Manchester because I had a grandfather living then in Liverpool, and it's fairly near. I knew nobody down in Plymouth. And I got sent to Stockport, actually, and to a very uncomfortable and drafty hospital in an old infant school, and didn't like it at all. And I wrote and told this to my mother in London, who wrote to her father, asked him whether he could do anything about it for me. And my grandfather, who was a Liverpool solicitor, was a very great friend of the medical officer to a private officer's hospital at Croxteth Park, the home of Lord Sefton. And this doctor, Wilkins, was a great friend of my grandfather's, and he was the civilian medical officer in charge of this hospital, a private hospital which the Earl of Sefton had given up about half his house, and there were about 30 officers. It was considered a great honour to get there. And my grandfather managed to pull strings to have me moved from this awful little hospital at Stockport to Croxteth Park. Of course, I was on crutches because of my foot, but I was only a mile from my grandfather's house, and the old boy was very pleased because I used to go and play bridge with him.
In what was the relationship between officers and men in the Royal Naval Division?
Not much different from anywhere else, I don't think. Not much different. No, we were integrated with the army too much. There wasn't much navy about it, you know. Most of us had never served in the navy, really speaking, and it was just the same. You thought of the men before yourself. You came out of the line and you saw that the men were fed, and that the men were issued with kit before you troubled about yourself. But that's an officer's job all the world over. It doesn't matter where you are. That's all part of the game.
Could you tell the difference between regulars, territorials, volunteers and conscripts? Were they differently treated?
No, I don't think so. No, they'd done away with all the TA badges and that sort of thing. They didn't wear those T, you know, used to wear T on the shoulder straps, but they didn't do it. They'd done away with all that. No, you couldn't possibly tell where anybody came from unless you got talking to them. But of course, in the Naval Division, we didn't have regular officers. There were only a handful at the very beginning, and I think they were mostly shifted away. Several of them got sent to sea service. They wanted to go to sea service, and they went to the service of the sea. Many of them did. These were quite different. There were some very, very fine people in the Naval Division. Freiburg was one, and there was a brigadier. There was a Commander Asquith, H.H. Asquith's sons. I forget his Christian name, but he lost a leg and won the DSO twice, I think. And there were all sorts of famous people. I can't remember, it's too long ago now.
Did you ever hear about the affair of Cobner's Beard?
Of who?
Cobner's Beard. Was that talked about at all?
Never heard of it. Cobner's Beard?
Yes. Did you ever encounter General Shute? General Shute.
Shute?
Yes, the divisional general. Did you ever encounter him?
There wasn't a general Shute named Shute. In the Naval Division? Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know. Didn't get that size general. No, there was a Wilson, I thought, was the divisional general. I think his name was Wilson when I was there. Don't think. Because I'll tell you something interesting now. When I went down with a dose of trench fever in January 1918, I had a temperature of about 106, very nearly died, and was sent to a hospital at Rouen. I had a very long period there, all through February, I think it was, I think I was there. And then in March, when the Germans made a very big, determined attack and got to within about 30 miles of Paris. They broke through on the whole front, tremendous. They dispatched a lot of us back up the line again, and I was sent out of hospital at Rouen, down to my base at Beaumary, and outside Calais, and I lost everything. I had nothing except what I stood up in. and I found myself on orders that evening to march to Calais station and on train entrain for the front. And I went to the adjutant and I explained that I hadn't a stitch except when I stood up in, and as much as a toothbrush. And could I have a bit of time off just to get some kit tomorrow? It was in the evening, this one. He put me back off the draft. Now, I would have been the second in command of that draft, and I would have marched at the tail with one run over the NCO. As they marched to the station, a German plane came over, and they dropped a bomb and killed 16 men and the officer on that draft. Mm. By such do you save your life. Mm. And I went up the line the next day. Nothing happened. And when I got up there, of course I'd been slightly gassed before, I suddenly lost my voice completely. Couldn't speak. I'd been just a touch of gas. And there was a United States medical officer in charge of the advanced base, getting experience. And he wouldn't take the responsibility of letting me go into the gas chamber to test my gas helmet, without which no man or officer could go up the line. Nobody was allowed up the line until they tested their gas chamber in themselves. Officer or man, didn't make any difference. And owing to my being gas and my having no voice, he wouldn't let me go in. And so I hung up about a week at this advanced base. I tried to get him to let me put another officer in to test my helmet, but he wouldn't let me do that. Finally, I managed to croak a few words, and I managed to persuade him. And I got into the fighting. We were trying to hold. We'd been taken out. The Naval Division had been taken out of the line. We'd been so early decimated, but we had to go back in again to try and hold the line to stop the Germans getting.